my turn to talk. Jeffrey, I'm sure, has prepared a very flattering introduction, and I'm going to sort of preempt that by just starting. Why are we here? We're here for the sake of the liturgy. But what about the liturgy? That it is beautiful. Ask a liturgist. Surely you would admit the liturgy should be beautiful. And things have improved. Sometimes they say yes. But very often, you'll meet a stunned silence because they've never thought about that. But what is beauty? What makes the liturgy beautiful? St. Thomas calls beauty that which, when seen, pleases. It's a rather surprising description, because it's only just a description, it's not a definition. It just describes what happens when you perceive beauty. And when you say that which, when seen, pleases, it could be mistaken for simply sensible pleasures. Surely that's not what beauty is. And if one simply takes it as sensible pleasures, this will lead to the balkanization of our liturgy, because everybody's sensible pleasure is something different. And then, if this were the case, you would actually have folk masses, chant masses, masses with hymns, mariachi masses, Polish polka masses, each group shunning the other. But of course, we know this will never happen. Rather, that which, when seen, pleases, the pleasure is not sensible pleasure only, but it is delight. It is an elevated pleasure that integrates enlightenment with enjoyment. And that enlightenment must include intellectual insight that leads to delight in the truth. Thus, beauty gives delight in the truth and thus engenders a desire for the truth, and to desire it because it is good. Hans Urs von Balthasar, the great German mega theologian, who has written a little treatise on beauty that runs to 8 volumes, in a moment of unexpected clarity, spoke about truth without beauty, that it does not persuade, and the good without beauty does not compel. So beauty is the glue that holds truth and goodness together. These things, truth, goodness, beauty, are what we call transcendentals. They are characteristics of all being in various degrees. Everything has a certain amount of beauty, a certain truth. But the highest of these truths, of truth, beauty, and goodness, is God, who possesses them perfectly. Indeed, is himself truth, beauty, and goodness. Thus, things that are particularly beautiful can lead to God, because he is the highest beauty. But still, what is beauty? We have given a description, that which, when seen, pleases. But what pleases? Consider the gradual from the Mass last Sunday. And you will sing it again, you will hear it again, this Friday. The text, Convertere Domine aliquantulum et deprecare super servos tuus. Turn back, O Lord, a little, and be appeased over your servant. And it, my point in mentioning it, is that it shows a kind of sense of order that is pleasing. It departs and returns to the same point as a goal. And the return to the goal is that which particularly pleases. So it sounds something like this. You'll have to forgive my scratchy voice. I used to be able to sing these better than I can now. Convertere Domine chant, with the unaccented note beginning below it. Convertere. And then it returns to that beginning note. From that beginning note, it then moves up and focuses upon a step higher, going up just a little bit more. Domine. To its focal point above the final. And then it begins to move back down again, ever so slightly. Et deprecare super servos tuos. And you see there it is now, come back down to the focal point where we began. And that arrival on the final is just what we expected and were hoping for. And when we get it, we're pleased, because it represents a kind of order. And the order is something that is symbolic of purpose. And these chants have clear purposes. So that's an element of the beauty of those chants, that the ordering of those, all of those notes, represents something that is larger than just the chant. It is something that is like everything else in the created universe. It represents a kind of order and purpose. But we still haven't really said about beauty. We've given some descriptions. The scholastics gave a definition. They called beauty splendor formae, the showing forth of the nature of a thing itself. When something is beautiful, it shines forth. What it is shines forth. And its characteristics are illumined, and it is made desirable as a good. So if one thinks about the analogy of being, all beings have some things in common. And because God is the highest being, then participation in any of these transcendentals can in fact be a participation in something that God holds in the highest perfection. And therefore, they can in fact lead us to God. What is the beauty of the liturgy? You won't be surprised to hear me say, the beauty of the liturgy is the music. That is to say, it's the music which makes the beauty of the liturgy, makes the truth of the liturgy shine forth. It is the beauty of the music that allows each part of the Mass to be differentiated from the other and its purpose to be clarified. And let me just suggest a few ways in which this works. For instance, the proper of the Mass are the parts which, generally speaking, the choir sings because they change from week to week. You can't expect a congregation to sing fancy Gregorian chant when it changes week to week. In fact, it's difficult to get a choir to do so. But you hear these are the chants from next Friday. You hear the communion chant. It sounds like this. Qui vult venire post me, omnice senet ipsu. There is a chant that has a couple of notes per syllable. It creates a sense of motion, and it is a suitable accompaniment for the procession of the entire congregation to communion. Compare that with the introit. Dominus fortitudo plebis sue et protecto saluta. A little bit more elaborate. It's distinguishable from a communion chant. Just creates a sense of solemnity, still a sense of motion, which in fact then suits the procession of the clergy into the church and accompanies them as they incense the altar. The offertory has a little bit different degree of elaboration. Effice Christus meus in semitis tuis. Just a little bit more elaborate than the introit itself. There's very little processional activity at the offertory. And what there is the incensation of the altar. So there you see three different levels of processional chants, from the simplest communion to the intermediate introit to the fancier offertory, that represent a degree of processional activity. But when it comes to the gradual and the Alleluia, there is something else going on. And that convertere, which I just sang for you, has then a verse that sounds like this. Notice what happens on the accented syllables and what happens on the unaccented syllables. Domine, accent on do. Domine. Yeah. to what you would expect. It rather expresses a kind of elaboration that almost departs from the text. Its function is more one of meditation than it is of accompaniment of activity. And in fact, you can observe the function of meditation when that chant is sung beautifully, which is a caution. Sing it beautifully. When it's sung beautifully, you can hear an absolute still in the church that you don't hear at other parts of the Mass. And the reason is that that chant focuses the listener's attention. It elicits recollection. And that recollection is both reposeful and attentive. The congregation is listening intently, and yet they have been set at peace. They are not making any distracting motions or sounds, but rather are brought to a state of recollection. That is purpose and order in the liturgy. The ordinary of the Mass is also a set of pieces which differs in kind from piece to piece. Kyrie, Gloria, Credo, Sanctus, Agnus. Kyrie, a petition, a litany. The general pattern of chant is that it has an arch form. It starts low, rises high, and descends back down again. Kyries, however, tend to have more descending motion, and that probably symbolizes the humility that's involved in saying the litany. For instance, Kyrie. Take the Kyriale and check out all the Kyries, you'll notice that about two-thirds of them have this sense of descending motion as their principal direction. The Gloria, on the other hand, is a hymn which includes a set of petitions in the middle, a litany in the middle, and the melodies of the Glorias then will represent those and differentiate the petitions from the hymnic parts. The Credo is quite a different text. It's a catalog of beliefs ordered in a logical order. And so its text is more predominant. Its melody is less prevailing. And so, Patrem omnipotentem, factor in celi et terre, visibilium omnium, et invisibilium. And the whole piece follows the same pattern. Prayers. There are three kinds of prayers in the Mass. The collects, the orations, that is to say, what the new books erroneously call an opening prayer. The collect at the beginning of the Mass is in fact the closing prayer of the entrance rite. You have lots of activity and lots of music, and then you bring it to a conclusion by a collect. Then everyone sits down. And then you begin the liturgy of the word. So there's one kind of prayer. The second kind of prayer is the preface. And the third kind of prayer is the Lord's Prayer itself. Here is how you would sing the first kind of prayer. Almighty God, who art all that is highest good, plant in our hearts a love of thy name, and grant an increase of religion, that you might nourish those things which are good, and by the cultivation of devotion, you might keep those things you have nourished. It simply represents the grammar of the text in the simplest possible way, differing the cadence at the end from the other cadences. Or it could be sung in a different way. Almighty God, who art all that is highest good, plant in our hearts a love of thy name, and grant an increase of religion, that you might nourish those things which are good, and by the cultivation of devotion, you might keep those things which you have nourished. See, it's just simply setting forth the text. The preface, on the other hand, seem to have missed a preface text, but the preface is a more elaborate prayer. Its language is in a higher style, and it has the same pitches that are used in the collects. Either the whole step pattern like that, or the minor third pattern like that. So the preface, da di da 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 di da, da di da 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 di. Da 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 ti da 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 da. See, that's a much more elaborate prayer. And what that says is, here comes now the more important part of the Mass. Without ever having to say it, it conveys simply the relative importance of those prayers. That same set of pitches, then, is the basis for the Lord's Prayer. Pater noster, qui es in celis, sanctificetur nomen tuum. You've already sung it tonight. And that, those pitches then, are the same as the preface, and the same as the two collects put together, but it is now a discrete melody. Again, something more substantive even than the preface was. Likewise, the lessons can be distinguished. It's quite easy, and you'll hear lessons sung this week. It hasn't been the custom to sing lessons. And I can remember a visiting priest coming to the Mass where my choir sang back in the late 70s. And he heard us sing the Mass, and he said, "Why, you sang the lessons." I'll bet there was not another church in the whole United States that had the sung lessons like that. It had become really the notion that the spoken lesson would be more effective than the sung. But we had an experiment. A pastor came in and said, "I don't want you to sing the lessons anymore." And so we stopped singing the lessons. And the congregation volunteered this information. We could hear the lesson better when it was sung, and we could understand it better when it was sung, because it wasn't impeded by the idiosyncrasies of an individual speaker. So, you see now, the lessons are differentiated one from the other as well. For the Old Testament, you would sing it like this. In the year of King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon the throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Above it stood the seraphim, each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he did fly. And one cried to another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." A wonderful way of singing an Old Testament text. Its ending formula sounds like a trumpet. It's a proclamation. the other hand, an epistle is sung to a more rhetorical tone. If there's anything that St. Paul is, it's rhetorical. He must have had a splendid education, and one in rhetoric. Because if you just look at the way sentences are constructed, even in translation, you see this really great sense for the effect of a sentence. So you get a tone like this. We who are baptized in Jesus Christ are baptized in his death. For we are buried with him through baptism in death. And just as Christ rose from the dead through the glory of the Father, so we will walk in new life. So that's a very different way of representing a lesson than the Old Testament. And then comes the gospel. You might expect the gospel would, in fact, be the most elaborate of all of the chants. In fact, it's the simplest. And my theory is that the parables of the gospel are wonderfully simple and direct, and this melody suits them. Every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. It is not possible for a good tree to make bad fruit, or a bad tree to make good fruit. Every tree which does not make good fruit will be cut down and thrown in the fire. And the beauty of that as well is that whereas the others had a more or less descending cadence, this has an ascending cadence. It ends like that, and it leaves you elevated. It distinguishes the gospel from the other lessons in an absolutely wonderful way. So you see that the music of the sung mass is its beauty, is its splendor formae, is the showing forth of its order and purpose and in the nature of its parts. And there's no question that this music, this chant, is sacred. In fact, the Gregorian chant is so unambiguously sacred that if by any chance you hear it in a non-sacred context, you don't say, oh, well, maybe it isn't sacred after all. You say, this is the wrong context. I remember hearing a Gregorian chant. It was the Monks of Silos recording in a Tony clothing store. And all I could think of was, why, that must be that Silos recording. What's it doing here? Or the Toyota commercial that uses the Missa de Angelis, as if they understood that a car went as fast as an angel. Of course they didn't, and they didn't even understand that it was sacred. But the fact is, you heard that, and it was only incongruous. So even though the texts are sacred, but so is the music. I think that's the most important thing. But consider the opposite situation. In place of the introit, a choir sings a song that is in imitation of a piece by a well-known pop group, or a song that is in the style of a Broadway musical. It may not be immediately evident that these styles are out of place, but they have their effect anyway. The lack of a sacred style undermines the sacredness of the liturgy and conveys the message that the liturgy is about the same thing as the secular world is about. That the liturgy is about the shallow sentimentality and stock situations found in Broadway musicals. It's true, liturgy should admit all forms of art that are suitable. But there is also a priority. Gregorian chant has first place in the liturgy. And the simple reason is just what I've told you. It is the form of the liturgy itself. Polyphony, however, also has a privileged place, and organ music has a privileged place. Concerted music gets honorable mention. The Schubert Mass is a good example of that. And we've wanted to have masses with orchestra for this colloquium so that you could see the spread of possible and acceptable styles of sacred music. Hymns also come into play. Hymns are good, actually. Some hymns are great. I have a particular fondness for the hymns of Ralph Vaughan Williams. There's a great sense for motion and for harmony in those pieces. Still, hymns do not quite fit the need of a processional chant. First of all, their texts are there for their own sake, not as an accompaniment of anything else. And their texts have been created so that they can be sung from beginning to end. Any number of my Protestant friend musicians will tell me that it is a violation of protocol not to sing all the stanzas of the hymn, no matter how many stanzas there are. And yet, what do? We sing two stanzas and stop. Chop it off right there. Likewise, this is the question of who should do the music. If the congregation is going to sing all of the ordinary, Kyrie, Gloria, Credo, Sanctus, Agnus Dei, that's really quite a bit to sing. Then the choir can sing the propers. And the reason for this is that those things which the congregation would sing, the ordinary, are in and of themselves the liturgical action. At the time you're singing the Gloria, it is a hymn of glory to God. Nothing else is going on. It is what's going on. The introit, on the other hand, accompanies the procession. And I've had the experience I sometimes go to English cathedrals and hear their liturgy because they do the liturgy so beautifully. But there's this one thing that Episcopalians do so well, and that is they put out a program of what's to be sung. And in the program it says, sing hymn number 751 in the Red Book to the melody of sing hymn number 53 in the Green Book. So you've got the program in your hand, and then you're holding the book, and then you're holding the other book, and you're looking back and forth between the two books, and then you realize that you've got to turn the page. And in the meantime, the procession has gone by and you've missed it. So the point is, the congregation shouldn't have to provide the accompanying music to the procession. That is for the professional group of singers who don't get to see everything about the procession. And if you've ever been to a really good, solemn Episcopal, that is to say, pontifical mass, or a ceremony in an Anglican cathedral in England, you will realize that the procession is something very beautiful. It also represents a purposeful ordering of things in preparation for the liturgy. And so to miss that is to is to miss your proper participation in the liturgy. So one then wants to challenge in some ways the notion that the congregation should be singing the propers of the Mass, even the gradual, because the gradual, which elicits recollection, makes the listener, prepares the listener to hear the lessons, and prepares the listener to hear the lessons in a deep way. Asking the congregation to repeat the same tired antiphon several times after verses sung by a cantor doesn't really make the same preparation. And I would contend that the participation of the congregation in the lessons, which is principally to hear the lessons, is advanced a good deal more when the choir sings the gradual beautifully than when the congregation are asked to sing the responsorial psalm. And I would say, as a footnote, you are permitted to sing the responsorial psalm in the choir. It isn't required that the congregation participate in singing those. Now, we've talked before, and we talk about the paradigm. I say the paradigm is principally the Gregorian Mass with all the parts sung. One of the great things, one of the better things about the new document, Sing to the Lord, from the American bishops, is that they make a strong statement that the priest should sing his parts. When the priest sings his parts, the parts of the choir and congregation take their place as an integral part of the liturgy. When the priest doesn't sing his parts, the singing of the congregation and choir seem a little bit less integral, seem a little bit more incidental. So there is then an integration of the liturgy that requires the priest to sing his parts. So the paradigm then is that some liturgy. And I think all of you who are here realize that it's the paradigm that we're trying to give you here. We're trying to illustrate for you and incorporate you into participation in the highest possible form of the liturgy as we can celebrate it. And we know that you may not be able to do that in your own parish to the extent that we're doing it here. But we think that the experience of this paradigm is something that you can bring to your own parishes to the extent that you can incorporate aspects of it. And that incorporation of the aspects of this paradigm is what I would call gradualism. Gradualism means gradually incorporating some of the parts of the Mass that are more suited. And many people are doing this now. The first thing that you can do is probably have them sing the Sanctus and the Agnus Dei and chant. I recently heard a new composition by Marty Hogan that was a kind of pseudo-chant. And I thought, why go to a pseudo-chant by Marty Hogan when here is a real Gregorian chant which the congregation can sing just as easily or perhaps more easily than the Marty Hogan piece? The fact is, some would argue, well, it's the Latin. Fine. Start by singing it in English. you'll discover that it isn't quite as good, and pretty soon you'll want to sing it in Latin. Likewise, the communion chant. If there's plenty of time at communion, so that you can sing the communion antiphon with alternate psalm verses. And there's still time for a hymn, there's still time for a little organ music if it's a lot of people going to communion. And the benefit is that your congregation will begin to recognize Gregorian chant as something that belongs to the liturgy. They will remember those chants, I would guess, at least as well as they remember the hymns. So the more the people can sing the ordinary, you can then add a Kyrie. You might begin with the Credo or the Gloria. Those are the more difficult ones, and yet those are feasible as well. The more the people can sing the ordinary, the more you can get the choir to sing the propers. But you will say, you don't have a choir at every Mass. You have a cantor at practically every Mass. It would be just as well if the cantor stopped doing this and began to sing even the simplest settings of the Mass propers. Psalm tones, if necessary, and if necessary, in addition to the hymn which the congregation sings. Because we have completely lost the sense that there are proper texts to be sung at the proper of the Mass. I was in Hungary last summer to a chant conference, and I asked the organizers, I decided to stay over the Sunday in Budapest to see what was happening liturgically. And I asked them where to go. They said, go to the Franciscan church near the university. It was quite interesting. I had known what their plan was, what their program was, and I disapproved. It was Hungarian adaptations of Gregorian melodies alongside hymns. It struck me that it was really stuffing the liturgy. So I went. The interesting thing was, I stayed for three different masses. Each priest, three separate priests, each one of them sang all of his parts. It was not the one high Mass on the Sunday, it was the way the Mass was celebrated on a Sunday. The congregation, this is something we don't particularly like, but here was a screen with the melody of the propers of the Mass projected in Hungarian. The entire congregation sang the propers of the Mass. And then they sang a hymn. It could have been far worse. It was really, I was extraordinarily surprised at how good it was, how well it worked. And the interesting thing was, at one of the Masses there was a choir that did some of the propers. At another Mass there was a group of three women who sang some of the chants themselves and sang a little polyphonic motet at the communion. At another Mass, it seems to me there was just one cantor. So the same paradigm was working in three different circumstances. I think that's something that can happen in any parish if you work at it. Rome wasn't built in a day. This colloquium, this 20th colloquium, wasn't as big as this even 4 or 5 years ago. It has grown tremendously, and I think it will continue to grow in one way or another, so that you just have to keep working at it. And I recall Father Key's talk last year, where he told about his own parish. He had a long-term plan. The first year, he celebrated the Mass singing all the parts and got the people to sing the Sanctus and the Agnus, something like that. The second year, he hired a new choir director and they began to sing some of the propers. The third year, adding more. the fourth year adding more. He now has a fairly significant number of people singing both Lauds and Vespers in his parish. So if you just work at it, if you have a plan, then you can really eventually have something really worthwhile. My own choir has been singing for about 40 years. And when we started, I remember the struggle it was to get the choir to sing the chant propers. It was like pulling teeth. It was really difficult. At this point, I can walk into a rehearsal and sing the beginning of any chant. Oenatus est nobis, and the rest of the choir will answer back the rest of the chant. They know those pieces from memory now. So there's a sense of continuity. The liturgy presumes you're going to do it for a lifetime, and you should build on that. English. You can rely upon doing some things in English. You can try making your own settings. You can use some of the settings that have been posted on our website. You'll discover eventually that you'll want to move on to something better. That is one of the reasons for giving you those, to give you an appetite for doing chant and for doing mass propers. Because once you get started, the bug hits you, and you can't stop until you've got it right. And so that is a way to really get going. Start it, do it gradually, add one thing at a time. You have also to check feedback. Talk to people when you've introduced something new and find out whether it really works, how they've received it. We had, about 3 years ago, our priest said, our mass was, the priest's part sung in English and the choir and congregation in Latin. The priest said, why are we doing this in English? And I couldn't stop him. He changed it to Latin. And I was worried that people would be put off. I talked to any number of people. Oh no, we like it. Fine, then we did it. The same priest, the same one, also went to a Spanish congregation north of Berkeley. And he said he tried to introduce a Latin Sanctus to this Hispanic congregation, and they hated it. And so he finally did it in Spanish. That's where you might have to start. And each congregation may be different. But the chant is going to be the key. The chant itself has a rhythm that evokes the sense of eternity. It does not have a regular, strong metric beat that projects a sense of temporality. Rather, it projects a sense of transcending the temporal. And so the chant can be that music that counteracts the balkanization of the liturgy. It's transcultural, it's transcendent, and it can be universal. And so you see that I have now told you about the beautiful, the sacred, and the universal, the three qualities that Pope Pius X, in his motu proprio, Tra le sollecitudini, defined as characteristics of sacred music. Just a couple of things about this week. I encourage you to sing the parts of the office. We will go, there's just time now, we will go to the chapel and sing Compline tonight. Tomorrow morning in the chapel at 7, we'll sing lauds. It's a bit of a rigorous schedule, but it only lasts a week. And you'll go away saying, oh, I'm so sorry that we don't continue to sing compline and to sing lauds. So I encourage you to take part in those. Our weekend as a whole will include these offices, will include chant choirs, will include breakout topics, and I would suggest that you notice that the morning breakouts are one class that lasts 5 days, so you'll want to go to that whole class. Whereas the afternoon ones are a little bit more independent, and you can select one day and another the other day. And then we'll have lectures like this, and there will be an interesting panel on Thursday about the role of music in higher education. And finally, the liturgies are in fact the focal point of the whole week. And I wish you the most sacred and the most beautiful and the most universal participation in all of it.